Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guests this week are Deborah Shriver, author of In the Spirit of New Orleans, Bella Blue, who's part of the troupe of naked girls reading Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and poet Dave Brinks, whose new collection is The Secret Brain. Deborah Shriver is a media executive with Hearst Communications who loves New Orleans as much as if she'd been bred and born here. She first chronicled that love affair in her 2010 book, Stealing Magnolias, Tales from a New Orleans Courtyard. And now she's back with a new celebration of her adopted city, the spirit of New Orleans. Hi, Deb.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, welcome. You're one of those hearty souls who loves New Orleans so much that you bought a house here. Right after Katrina.
I did. We actually found, you know, a wonderful house. We had been coming here for several decades. I grew up on the Gulf Coast, the other side of Mobile, fell in love with New Orleans, love at first sight, and thought, you know what? I can forego room service if I have a house. And found a house 3 weeks before Katrina. Katrina happened. Couldn't really close on the house because the courthouses were closed, the offices were closed here, and did some soul searching, but not very much, not for long, because we really wanted to be here, and we were one of the first houses to close in the French Quarter. The city was about 80% underwater, as you know, and we were on high ground. The house came through like a warrior princess, not a tile off the roof, ready and waiting for us. We moved in November without a stick of furniture. Slowly, I've bought art. I've combed Magazine Street. I really wanted it to be a shrine to New Orleans, and it gave us a footprint in the city. You know, I'm a Southerner. I wanted to come back, but I felt like New Orleans was home. I've always felt that way. I say that it has never disappointed. I never want to leave when I get here. It's just the joie de vivre. There's so many things about it. Someone asked me the other day, they said, well, what is it that you like about New Orleans? And I said, I can give you a million reasons. I just can't give you one.
Exactly. Now, that first book was so personal. It's such a sharing of your taste, your style. People get so many ideas from it. Your recipes, too, which are quite wonderful. But this book is personal as well in a different way, isn't it?
You know, what I wanted to do, I wrote both books very quickly. These are the only two books I've ever written. I wrote them both in about 7 months. And I realized that when I had fallen in love with New Orleans, I really became a student. You know, I read a lot about it. There's so many wonderful books on Louisiana and this part of the country. I read a lot of cookbooks. I went to the Williams Research Center. I would go on little walking tours around the city. So when it came time to do both books, it was as though I had done the research. And I wrote them very quickly because I realized I knew a lot and I had talked to a lot of people over the years and I had saved all these wonderful quotes and articles about New Orleans. And the second book, In the Spirit of New Orleans, is really what I call a calling card and also a love letter to the city, because so much has changed after Katrina, but in a good way. There are hundreds more restaurants. There's real energy here. There's enterprise. And what I wanted to do is put together a book that said, this is New Orleans today.
Well, this is a very lavish photographic book, and the images are so beautiful, and there is such a range of vintage and contemporary photographs, paintings, all sorts of things. What were you looking for as you selected these?
Well, someone asked the other day, they said, tell us what to eat and what jazz to listen to in New Orleans. People say, where do I go and what do I eat? So what I did with this book is I said to them, go to the tried and true, you know, go to the traditional, but try the new. Go to the old absinthe, go to the French 75 bar, go to the carousel at the Monteleone, but go to Cure, go to Bartonique, go to Sobu, you know, go to Frenchman Street, go to the House of Blues, but also go to the I Club. So the thing that's so great about New Orleans is it keeps changing. John Scott, the artist, said that it was the original melting pot in America, and I really believe that. It's such a juxtaposition and a contrast of cultures, and it adds things anew.
So that informed what you were looking for when you were looking for these pictures and choosing the way it would look.
Right. And New Orleans is a city, not only does it have a long history, it has an incredible visual history. Mm-hmm. In graphic arts, mixed media, there's so many artists here. There's several banks of photography. So we were able to include old Mardi Gras photographs. You know,
I love those.
Those are great. And in this book, I have to say my favorite section is on jazz, because there are pictures of Lightnin' Hopkins. There's a picture of Trombone Shorty and how he looks today. I mean, he looks like Lenny Kravitz today. But there's a picture of him in his bloomers with Bo Diddley in the background, egging him on his big trombone when he was a little guy at Jazz Fest. You know, there's pictures of Mahalia Jackson singing. There are pictures of Professor Longhair. There are pictures of Fats Domino playing the piano with that pinky ring that is a diamond piano. I mean, just really a fabulous mix of old and new.
One of my very favorite ones is Ben Jaffe toddling out of the door of Preservation Hall, and then Ben Jaffe all grown up now playing with the band. That sense of the passage of time is everywhere in this book. Our city has really become your muse in a way.
It really has. But you know, it's funny. I was at Maple Street Bookstore last night, and what started as a little talk on New Orleans ended up being a group therapy session where we all went around the room and said what we loved about New Orleans. And it's not just me. I mean, there's something about the city. And as I said, you know, I can give you a million reasons. I can't just give you one. And people say, well, it has to be the people. And I think it does start with the people here. I mean, the South is full of people who practice Southern hospitality. But New Orleans has a real personality, and it has the rich culture and history to back it up. It has a little bit of Europe. It has the best of so many places. It has the best, you know, French architecture, Spanish food, Haitian culture. It just has a mix of old and new, and it's constantly changing. I do think the energy here in terms of the people and what's going on, and you might have seen that Travel and Leisure just this week named New Orleans the top U.S. destination.
I love that.
I think it's a real comeback story.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, share with us what your perfect New Orleans day would be like.
That would be easy. I start by having bowls of cafe au lait in my courtyard. The courtyard, I just hang out in it. I love being outside. I can't do this in New York City. I read the papers. I have a long, leisurely morning. I always, always take a walk in the quarter. I like being on foot. That's the decision to move really to the quarter as the neighborhood that we wanted to be in. I like to walk the levee, the moonwalk. I like to stop by the Historic New Orleans Collection and see what they have. I love perusing books at Faulkner House Books. I sometimes get a table at Napoleon House facing the street so I can watch people go by. I like to do that. Yesterday, I sat at the bar at Sobu, had a glass of wine, had some pork cracklings with queso sauce. Sometimes I'll go for a swim at the Royal Orleans, but we find that when we're here, we're on a siesta schedule. You know, that Europeanness seeps in, and you can break your day up, because in New Orleans, there's always jazz playing in the afternoon somewhere. There's always a cocktail hour somewhere.
So true.
And there's just a lot of culture here. Mm-hmm. I find that when I get on the plane to go back to New York, I'm always missing something.
Yeah. How has living here changed you?
We were talking about this last night at Maple Street Bookstore. We were saying that there's a sense here of enjoying the moment. And there's a lot of spontaneity here. We were going out to dinner with our next door neighbors one night, and it's a 2-block walk to Mobar. So we meet them out on the sidewalk. We turn the corner. There was a two-block parade with a marching band with floats that was about three blocks long, and it passed us as we walked into the restaurant.
It doesn't get any better than that. It really doesn't.
And, you know, there are a lot of artists here. The Quarter's really thriving right now. There are stalls in the French Market again with artisans. Mm-hmm. There's food everywhere. Jazz is always playing somewhere.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying all these New Orleans moments and sharing them with us. We've been talking with that New Orleans-loving woman, Deborah Shriver, whose new book is In the Spirit of New Orleans. Thanks so much.
Thank you for letting me be here.
Bella Blue is the headmistress of the New Orleans School of Burlesque, as well as a performer with Fleur de Tis and a solo performer. In the coming week, she'll be part of a performance by Naked Girls Reading. And what will Naked Girls be reading, you might ask? Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. What else? Should make for some holiday fun. Bella Blue, welcome to the Reading Life.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you and I have known each other for quite a while.
Yeah, a couple years.
So I'm glad we have a chance to talk like this.
Yeah, this is exciting.
So, Naked Girls Reading, how did you get involved with this?
Naked Girls Reading is an event that started about 4 years ago in Chicago, but it's now worldwide. It was started by a couple, Michelle Lamour and Frankie Vivid, in an attempt to capitalize on, they've worked very hard with their burlesque personas and their presence in the burlesque world, but to do something else outside of burlesque. The thing about this is that while we're embracing and celebrating woman's nude body, just similar to how we do in burlesque, it's different. It's being presented in a way, you're being read to. I've been calling it adult story time. It's just the only way that I can think of it, is that you're drinking spiked hot chocolate and you're being read to. And I've been asking people, it's like, when is the last time somebody read to you? You know, it's probably been a long time. You know, I don't know that happens very often in your adult life. And to be read to and celebrating such a fun season in such a unique way, I mean, it just makes so much sense that this made its way down to New Orleans. So
what do you think being naked adds to reading?
I think what it adds to reading is, just like with burlesque, I always say that a good burlesque act, at the end of the act, yes, the girl is typically nude or mostly nude at the end of her act. But if the act is good, then you're less inclined to be focusing on the nudity, and it's more about how she got that way. Mm-hmm. I think that with adding the nude effect to being read to is more of an appreciation for the naked body, even that much more when it's coming, you're being read to by an intelligent, beautiful woman. Stories that remind you of your childhood.
Now, I'm a big fan of naked reading, but yes. I usually do it in bed or in the bathtub.
Right.
Exactly. So will you be reading Charles Dickens ahead of time? Will you be practicing?
I'll be reading Charles Dickens, and then we've each been given the opportunity to kind of pick what else we would like to read on our own.
Oh,
so
great.
The night's going to go for about an hour and a half long. And it will be broken up into three sections. There'll be breaks in between, give everyone a chance to stretch their legs, get a drink, and socialize a little bit, and then hunker back down.
Now, I asked a friend to go with me, and he mm-hmm. said he just wasn't sure he would know where to look. So do you feel a special responsibility to do a good job as a reader?
I do. I feel a special responsibility, but I also feel that, Frankie, the one of the creators of this, he said that the thing about the naked female body is that it can still be concealed.
That's true.
And it can still, and if you're sitting and you're holding a book, there's still some mystery there. Can still be concealed. It's not typically all out there for everyone to see. So I think that should tame the nerves of people who who maybe aren't so sure what to do with themselves when they sit down to get read to by a naked girl.
Now, holiday reading is very special and traditional, and people have all their rituals about it. Maybe this will become the new holiday ritual.
That would be great.
But what about this story appeals as the topic for naked girls reading?
I think with it just being such a classic, quintessential, just like the Nutcracker, just like childhood books from
The Grinch,
songs, just like the same 15 Christmas carols, but you, at some point, you still love all of them, even though you've heard them over and over and over again. I think that this story is the same, and adding this element of nudity to it will just make that memory that much more exciting.
And complicated.
And complicated, because you're associating it from when you were a child,
right.
And now you're an adult. And then one day you'll just be an old man or woman in your wheelchair going, you remember that one time?
We thought we'd give you a sense of what naked girls reading sounds like, since we can't show you what it looks like. So Bella's going to read a little bit for us.
And we'll let you guess if I'm naked or not in the studio.
Exactly.
Just use your imagination.
So here's the beginning of A Christmas Carol.
Marley was dead, to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it, and Scrooge's name was good upon. Change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. Mind, I don't mean to say that I know, of my own knowledge, what there is particularly dead about a doornail. I might have been inclined myself to regard a coffin nail as the deadest piece of ironmongery in the trade. But the wisdom of our ancestors is in the simile, and my unhallowed hands shall not disturb it, or the country's done for. You will therefore permit me to repeat emphatically that Marley was as dead as a doornail.
I love that. Well, you can meet Bella Blue and see Bella Blue at Naked Girls Reading Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, Wednesday, December 19th at 9 p.m. at the Paris Room at 720 St. Louis. Tickets are available at brownpapertickets.com. Thanks, Bella.
Thank you so much.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
I ain't got no time for a nap. Oh, no, no. I gotta make this holiday glow.
Like a light bulb.
Tie it all up in a big shiny.
Dave Brinks devotes his life to poetry. His wife is poet Megan Burns, and his children Minna and Blaze and Issa are named for poets. Almost any Thursday night, you can find him at the Goldmine Saloon, where he and Megan host the 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series. And if Dave's not there, he's probably reading his work somewhere else in the country. He's the publisher of Trembling Pillow Press, editor-in-chief of the literary journal Yop, and publisher of Entrepot, the Brain Trust News in Arts and Letters. Today, he's here to talk about his new book, The Secret Brain, Selected Poems 1995 to 2012. Welcome, Dave.
Hey, how you doing, Susan?
There's a lot of work involved in putting together selected poems like this. You know, 17 years of work. What was your criteria for inclusion?
I like books to write themselves, and the methodology that I gave myself over into this book and the arrangement of it, I wanted the poems to constellate, and I used the I Ching. And so I always invite in a measure of chance in the way that the book will constellate and orchestrate itself. That's the underpinning of this book. In many of the books that I write, I prefer to give myself over to chance and then let the ethers and the universe say exactly how it's supposed to be.
And each section of the book is introduced by this beautiful artwork.
Yes, Joshua Walsh, one of the most amazing gentlemen and spirits I have ever known. He is has an aptitude and an aperture in his eye and heart to capture the real essence of a space. He's done it with musicians, street people in New Orleans for 20 years. He's one of the initial people that I really shared a kinship with early on and like to collaborate with. So it was a great joy for me to ask him to specifically draw pictures, beautiful art, frontispieces for each section of the book, and he did a seamless and terrific job.
Oh, they're so beautiful. And you did the cover collage as well.
I love collage. I can't paint my way out of a paper bag, but collage I can do. Mm-hmm. I love collage.
And the I Ching's always been so important to you. I think of those bookcases
in
your house
That's right.
With that sliding shelf in front of the three in the back.
Yeah.
Oh, I've always loved that. Now, this title is so evocative, coming as it does from Dylan Thomas. Describe what that means to you, the secret brain.
Well, I am not afraid to say that. I mean, I occasionally have auditory hallucinations. I did suffer from epilepsy for many years, which is kind of a derangement of the senses where you think you have a hearing eye or a seeing ear. But actually, I think that from a cognition standpoint, that construction of the way that the brain, the apparatus of the brain does operate, lends itself to being open towards receiving beautiful words and sounds. And so the secret brain to me, it doesn't matter whether, you know, it's a gazelle laughing like a giraffe, but these things are very potent and very core deep images and sounds that I give myself over to and follow. And so the secret brain is kind of some larger space that I'm just able to have a frequency and tune into.
Some gift that you've been given.
Yeah, sometimes.
Now, these poems cover so much ground, love, parenthood, mythology. You're just grabbing inspiration from everywhere, it seems.
Yeah, I keep myself open. I think that, you know, is to be a writer, a poet in the community particularly, is to wrap some skin and heart around it. And so that means that whatever your son or daughter might say, it's like squirrels bringing, you know, nuts back to their space, you know. They build up this reservoir of so many trails of different ideas and possibilities in the imaginary space of that. So I pay attention to maybe even the squeaking of a streetcar as it's going, the melodicness of that, and then what is in the environment around it. It informs me what I need to be looking at.
I wonder if you'd read one of the poems that I love so much. It's called As Stars Are.
I would love to. Thank you. As stars are like the movies, a gala occasion, all day, and what fun to know their names. The Whale Nebula is Mina's favorite. Even so, where else is one to go, singing animal songs, all those radio waves, blazing suns? I wonder if the whales ever think about us. That song tastes like pineapple. That's funny, Mina says, and it is. The season of delight beneath the glistening earth, whose sheen deepens inside the windows. I reach for one, which is traveling in two directions, and to you for having given birth to a butterfly under the Botticellian trees, and to an alphabet sung nightly, which is never dark.
I love that poem. A lot of your poems, a lot of the ones you've included here, are dedicated to other poets. And it makes me think of all these poets who've been so important to you all throughout your writing life. How do you choose to dedicate a poem to another poet? It's such a generous moment in literature, you know?
People are what inspire me, always have been. There is always, particularly now, we are confronted with the sense of aloneness sometimes in the world, which is kind of, you know, a strange thing if you have 6.5 billion people on the planet. But I think that your friends become your family as much as your family. And that's a New Orleans thing. But I think it's another thing with a lot of other communities that share in the deep river of that ancestral vision. I always seem to think that the one thing that makes sense to me, or two actually, I think of it as my friends inspire me and I write a poem or dedicate it to them or my daughter or someone else. I always think the gift that we have is we are the same age our ancestors were when they were our age. And if you attach that to one other thing, that opens a beautiful window. And then if you think about the resonance of Louis Armstrong's great credo, which I hold very highly in great regard, as he said, everything I've ever done is dedicated to the cause of happiness. So after that, the party's on.
I remember Stanley Crouch wrote a wonderful article about Armstrong for the New York Times, and he said he was an ambassador for joy.
That's right.
And I've always loved that expression, you know. And a lot of these poems are also not just dedicated to other poets, but written in collaboration with them. And that seems to be an important thing that you love to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because, you know, it's a collaboration living in a neighborhood. All of the nuances and idiosyncrasies of the people and the birds and the trees and the squirrels in the space of the sounds of which we inhabit. So it's almost a communion with a collaboration as a poem and letting someone else take turns. It's almost that New Orleans style ensemble of jazz, mm-hmm. where not one person's going to really have a solo. Everybody's going to kind of bring the sound up together and then down, as they say, until they can hear the feet on the ground.
When you looked at this, when you finally put this together, were you ever amazed at your own accomplishment? This is, you know, 300 pages of work.
Well, there were many poems that...
that aren't in there, I know.
Well, and there were many poems that were actually lost, and I found during the process of building the house of the book. And I was so happy to be able to get those between the pages, too. But I think this is just the work that we do as people. The part of the equation that is the most important is the people part of the equation. And of course, in New Orleans, you need to make some good art, too. So I think it's like a good meal that people take time with. And that's what you do.
Well, it's a very good meal, I have to tell you. We've been talking with Dave Brinks, whose impressive new collection is The Secret Brain, Selected Poems 1995 to 2012. Congratulations on a life in poetry, Dave.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. There will be a book launch party with the authors of New Orleans by New Orleans, Tuesday, December 18th from 7 to 9 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Ben Capel reads from his book Victory, and poet Alan Peterson signs Fragile X, the second title in the McSweeney's poetry series, Wednesday, December 19th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop Uptown. Today's guest, Bella Blue, appears as part of Naked Girls Reading Charles Dickens A Christmas Carol, Wednesday, December 19th at 9 p.m. at the Paris Room, 720 St. Louis Street. Tickets available at brownpapertickets.com. Kit Wohl signs New Orleans Classic Cocktails, Friday, December 21st from 5 to 7 at the Roosevelt Hotel. Today's guest, Deborah Shriver, signs In the Spirit of New Orleans at Hazelnut, 5515 Magazine Street, Sunday, December 23rd from 3 to 4:30 p.m. Poet Melinda Palacio signs How Fire is a Story Waiting, Saturday, December 29th from 3 to 5 at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center, and again Sunday, December 30th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. And time for a shout-out to Ben Sandmill, whose Ernie Cato, the R&B Emperor of New Orleans, was named one of the best nonfiction books of 2012 by Kirkus Reviews. Congratulations, Ben. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.